Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Michael Lopp. He is VP of Engineering at Slack. He is known online as Rans, and he is the author of a couple of books, Being Geek and Managing Humans. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I am super excited for our chat. So I'm going to get going right away with the first question, give you a chance to talk a little bit about what you do at Slack. So what does being VP of engineering at Slack mean to you? How would you define your major roles, your top priorities?
Yeah, it's kind of a dream job for me. Slack is, we've got two folks that are managing and leading engineering. There's me, the VP of engineering, Michael Lopp, and then there's Cal Henderson, who's the CTO and one of the co-founders of Slack. And those two roles really give me sort of a clear idea of what I'm responsible for and what in this case Cal is responsible for. So my job as VP of engineering, well, there's a real simple way to describe it, which is Cal built the machine, and my job is to run the machine and make sure that it's running well. That's like the simple version of the answer. Mm-hmm. The slightly more detailed version is I'm responsible for the people and the product and the process, the 3 P's. Those are the things that I am thinking about, thinking strategically about, investing in. Like, those are the things that are like my joy to be responsible for working on. And it's not that I'm not doing the technology, but like that's like Cal is 17,000 times better than that, and I am. So it's really interesting. We're an interesting pair because we're very complementary set of skill sets. But it also, I think, is sort of how I would, or somewhere else, how I would sort of cleanly divine, cleanly split the role of VP of engineering and CTO. And those are my top priorities for that. Health and effectiveness of the humans, how are we building process to scale the team or the product, and how are we building the product, how are we designing it, how are we developing it, and how are we deploying it. So just that.
Got it. And is one of the reasons why you would describe it as your dream job because it has those all three of those P's, the people, the process, and the product?
Yeah, it is. It's that I get to be focused on the things that I think I'm best at, which are those 3 P's. But also the reason it's a dream job is Slack, the product, and sort of my leadership philosophy, which is your team being healthy is how you are an effective leader, is Slack helps teams be healthier, more transparent, kind of get rid of some of the cost of communication and kind of get things done. And that's the dream job, is to build a product that's in line with your personal values.
Got it. It's so great to hear that it's not to have somebody say, wow, I'm living my dream job, that sometimes you have to pinch yourself and realize, wow, you know, it's in some cases lucky, I guess you could describe it, because not everybody can do that. But I know that you've worked hard to get there, that this is not your first rodeo, so to speak. So can you just talk a little bit about how, you know, for folks who are thinking, oh, how does one land one's dream job? what was the path that kind of led you there?
30 years of trial and error. It's no big deal. I'm joking, but I'm actually kind of serious too. I think there's a couple of contributing factors to that. Number one, and these are out of order. Number one is like, do you know what you're good at? Like every time that I've tried to do a job because I'm enthusiastic or passionate, but I'm not really good at the thing, it ends up in tears. So like, it's taken time and years and some humility and some hard lessons to be like, I am good at these 3 things or whatever, those 5 things. So that's number one is, can you do that? And that took years of trial and error. And I mean, and by the way, everyone's telling you what you're good at. Oh, you're good at people, Bob, Michael, whatever your name is. But actually choosing a job which is totally aligned with that, you know, takes a little bit of work. The other thing is, I bore incredibly easy, and I have had an opportunity to kind of change my job every 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I tell this to everybody, this isn't a secret. It's like written down and everything, just because I just believe that you've always got to be pushing yourself and growing. And that means changing the scenery and changing the set of folks. And that doesn't mean switching, like leaving a company. You can change the job enough to kind of restart that. But mm-hmm. I can't imagine a job where I'm not like about 28% scared, like what's going on? You know, because that scare, that fear, that's not a great way to frame it, is sort of like what drives me. Is like, I want to figure out how this works and what's next mm-hmm. and how do I do more? And that sort of constantly choosing a path which is slightly harder mm-hmm. is invigorating, but also teaches you those lessons about what you're good at and what are the things you like and what are the things that you dislike. So, and you know, so I've seen a lot. I mean, Borland, Netscape, Apple, Palantir, Pinterest, Slack, a startup you've never heard of. I've been to a lot of different places. I've seen a lot of things. So I have also a wealth of experience, which hopefully gives me better judgment because mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of things. It's not my first rodeo. So mm-hmm. I had a meeting with a bunch of interns this summer, and someone asked the question. They're like, so what's next, Mr. Person who gets bored quickly? I'm like, no, I'm good. This is it. Like, I don't want to be the CEO. This is literally the job that I want. Mm-hmm. And this is a bunch of interns who are just starting, and they're like, wow, you can get that. I'm like, and you can. We'll see how long it lasts, you know, because I do have this moving board, but I'm super, super happy with kind of where I am right now.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And it's interesting to hear you say that fear is one of the things that drives you, because there are people who are at the opposite end of the spectrum where it's fear is what they avoid at all costs. So do you think you've always been that way, or is that something that's kind of evolved over the course of your life or your career?
It's the basic attribute of how I'm built, is that as a part of technology on the planet Earth, is you just are intimately aware that it's constantly evolving. So the probably the core fear is that you wake up some year and you're really good at Fortran, working at this company that's really good at Fortran. You're like, when the hell did that happen? And it's like, what? Like, no one cares about Fortran. I'm exaggerating, but mm-hmm. that's the thing about, you look at my career of databases, browsers, e-commerce, operating systems, data again, advertising, and now here in collaboration. It's always something new and interesting, but it's driven by this desire to kind of stay on top of this rapidly developing industry, which is my joy, but it also is there's a little bit of fear in there that you wake up someday and you're like, what? It just passed me. Like, it completely passed me. And I felt that way since I was 17, and I feel that way now.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about tools. I know that you're a fan of talking about different kinds of tools and software tools and physical tools and things like that. So let's put it within the context of keeping you at the top of your game career-wise. So when you think about tools, whether it's software tools, physical tools, or even like mindset tools or mindset habits or rituals, is there anything that comes to mind that has really, really helped you to stay at the top of your game career-wise?
I think the big one here, and this feels kind of like a cliche, which is I'm intensely protective of my time, because every minute matters during the day. And I want to say something that's paradoxical in a second about that. The way that I manage my time is indicative of, I should be investing every minute correctly. And that means having a really clear sort of rules around my productivity system, which I can describe, and also how I manage my calendar and how much time I have, you know, to think about things versus be in meetings and do tactical stuff. So whatever tool helps me, and it's less tool and more sort of a practice mm-hmm. to kind of stay on top of everything that needs to be done in a day, that's like the tool that I care about. And I've lost my mind over productivity systems, and I've tried dozens, I don't know, 50, 100. And I'm back to a very simple practice, which I've written about, which is I have a to-do list that I keep in just a text editor. And I can only have about 10 items on that list at any given time. These are small rock things. These are like, you know, rewrite the internal transfer policy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are small things. And I can only have 10 on there, which means if you ask me, if you're like, hey, do this thing up, I have to take something off that and maybe communicate to someone that I'm not going to do that, or you know, and it's about keeping a set of things that I know are actionable and important. I also have basically one big project, mm-hmm. that big rock that I'm working on a week, that is my time to, that's the thing that has to be done. And by the way, there's like 8 of those at any given time, but I know this about myself. I can't do more than one at a time. If I try to do 3, I do 3 things poorly, as opposed to like, this is the thing that I'm doing this week. And that forces me to prioritize, not my time, but people are dependent on me for things. And one of the big rocks is number 3 on the list. That means it's almost a month away before I'm going to do it. And I have to have that conversation with Bob and say, Bob, this is not happening. He's like, great, okay, I'll reset expectations. Everything that I'm describing here is about me being able to have a finite set of normal things on my list on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And there's an important, you didn't ask this, but there's an important byproduct of that, which is I can't be busy. I can't be sending to the rest of the world that I'm busy. Mm-hmm. When someone DMs me on Slack or sends me a mail and says, I know you're super busy, it kind of like stabs me in the heart, because what they're saying, they don't mean it like they're saying it, but like I'm hearing it. But I, as a leader, have time for everybody. And when you come to me, if I'm busy, what I hear in busy is like, I've got too many things and I'm like running between stuff. And that's bad leadership, mm-hmm. right? I have all those things to do. I have a lot of stuff to get done. I have a lot of people that are depending on me, but I'm never, ever busy. I don't want that mindset to be, that mindset scares me. I'm talking about fear a lot today. I'm not sure why. Mm-hmm. I don't like that. And the moment that I ever get into like someone's mind, like, oh, wow, you're really tired and busy, I'm like, whoa, system breakdown. We are prioritizing the things, delegating, I'm doing all that sort of stuff. So the tools are really simple. The principles of stay on top of things, be reliable, you know, be approachable. These are the things that are, the principles are more important to me than the tools on a day-to-day basis. When I can talk for an hour about my favorite text editor too, by the way. but in terms of it's really the principles that I'm optimizing for.
That makes a ton of sense. That it's the principles and it's the systems perhaps, mm-hmm. but not necessarily the exact tool. It's about following the principles. Is that kind of what you learned as you went through like the 1.5 million different kinds of get things done productivity systems, that you're like, hey, there's so many out here, I'm just gonna create the one that works the best for me, that aligns with how I want to do this and aligns with my principles.
Yeah, and it's like, it's one of, this is just to talk about Slack for a minute. It's one of the reasons I like Slack, is because whether you like Slack or not, if your company, if your team is moving over to Slack, the interesting thing that you learn in moving to Slack is all the things that you don't like that you're doing inside of email. And that's what I love about it, is Slack is different for Slack than it is for other customers, because it's sort of this set of communication principles. But what it really is sort of reimagining how you want to communicate with the rest of your team. And like, when's the last time we did that? Like, many years ago? You know, we've been talking about wikis and blah, 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 and all this stuff forever. But like, that's the thing that's interesting, is like finding a new way to work. And that's, to me, whether it's flat, that's the thing, is finding that sort of optimal way of managing my time and communicating with my team.
Got it. And I want to go back to this busy thing, because it's really, really interesting. And I myself follow that I don't want to be busy kind of principle and mindset, that if I am, that means I'm doing something wrong. If there's not enough space in my calendar, then I'm not, like you said, prioritizing enough or delegating enough. But, you know, looking at it from the other perspective, there is this, it's the hustle culture. I guess that's the best word that I can use to describe it. You know, you got to hustle, which is maybe one of the connotations of that is you have to be busy. You have to constantly be doing something, or else you're not trying hard enough, or else you're lazy. So how would you respond to somebody who might suggest that?
There's a cultural assumption in what you're asking there, which is like that hustling matters. And I would argue that, and I understand what you're saying, but I would argue what I care about is am I delivering the value? Am I creating value in the things that I'm doing? And I would argue that I think the reason, to speak for you for a second, sorry, tell me if I'm wrong here. The reason we both don't like busy is it's not sort of the optimal mental state for getting things done, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's why we don't like it, because it's that sense of kind of feeling on your heels and like I'm behind or whatever that is. The hustle piece is kind of like status that people have. It's sort of like, it's the people that like say that I'm going to be look busy and I'm going to hustle because that's going to send a signal that I'm getting things done. And I think that's transparent and wrong. And I think what actually matters is, are the things that you say you're going to do, are you getting them done in a way that is exemplary? Are you supporting your team in a way that they're like, whoa, he or she is like on top of things? And mm-hmm. you can do that, I would suggest, that without the hustle. You can do that in a family-friendly, 9-to-5, you know, way. And that hustle thing, I think, is sort of an artifact of Silicon Valley, like death marches and whatnot, that, by the way, just aren't healthy and they aren't scalable. And by the way, it's fun. I understand, like, that sense of, like, I have so much to do and that's exciting. But again, as a leader, is that the message that you want to be sending to your team? Is like, I'm doing a lot of things and I'm busy and I'm getting them half done, but I've got so much going on. There's a cultural thing that you're observing that I think is fundamentally bad leadership. The hustle thing, the busy thing. I see them as sort of the same word in my head.
Yep. And I absolutely agree with you that the busy mindset is not an optimal mental state to be in if you are going to get things done, if you are going to be an effective, exemplary leader. And so speaking of mental state, just one more thing on the topic of tools and systems and principles. Do you follow any mindset practices, you know, daily rituals, daily habits or anything that are really more focused on that mental state and keeping you in that peak mental state? Do you have any habits or rituals there that are important?
Yeah, really boring answers, but I believe that they're incredibly important. First of all, let me say one that I don't do anymore, but I'll tell you why I don't do it. I think, what's that called? Headspace, the little online meditation thing. Mm-hmm. I just loved it for like about three or four months ago. I was like 4 or 5 months of it. It's sort of like, you know, you listen to this 10-minute thing, you kind of get in the zone, you calm yourself down. But the reason I stopped doing it is because, why am I doing it? Well, we've already talked about this. I'm doing it because I'm busy and I've got too much in my head, which means, and it's like needing to meditate is a trailing indicator of something wrong further upstream, which is I signed up for too many things. I prioritize. Like, and by the way, meditation, lovely, awesome thing, but meditation as a de-stressor seems backwards to me. Right? Because like I am so stressed and you're gonna meditate, but like it's late. You're doing that after all the damage has been done. That's what you want to do before. So the before things are super simple and they're really, really easy, which is, are you exercising? I exercise all the time. I ride my bike. I do some of my best thinking when I'm on my bike, which is allowing me to sleep better because I'm exercising. Your body loves to exercise. It rewards you with all these wonderful endorphins when you're done. And it also allows you to sleep better. Mm-hmm. And also, finally, sorry, the most boring list of three, eating. I like took soda out a while ago, and it was a lovely thing to realize how dependent I was on it. And I felt it with LaCroix, just like bubbly, like no sugar water, right? But all of these three things you do are upstream things that allow you, plus, you know, time management and good leadership, allow you to kind of like have sort of a good foundation to build on. I love meditation. My parents in California, so I've got like hippie parents, so like I understand that piece, but like if I'm going to meditate and I'm going to do that headspace, I'm going to do it Saturday morning, right? Mm-hmm. Before the day starts. You have to be like, all right, I got a book to finish. I'm excited about this. I want to be in a good space, so I'm going to meditate there. Not like as a decreaser of all the stress. So the staying on top of the game is just doing those things your body naturally craves and doing them regularly. It's really easy, just like being busy, to like grab the string cheese or whatever your guilty pleasure is and do that, those are ultimately going to compound into sort of a worse mental health. So easy to say, very, very hard to do, by the way.
Yeah, so eat well, get your sleep, exercise. It almost sounds too simple, right? But that's it, right? You don't even need to meditate if you're doing those things.
That's something that you find
helpful. And I love your approach to meditation. I've used Headspace. I love it. I don't use it as a de-stressor. Yeah. I use it more as a daily ritual to keep me focused, and then I can apply it in other parts of my life. Everybody approaches it differently, so you do what helps for you. And I think that it's just important that we realize that this mindset stuff is just so important. So I'd love thank you for giving us your take on that.
Well, the other thing is, when I don't sleep, or when I'm not eating well, or I don't exercise, it's the same thing as the busy thing. It's an indication of a system breakdown somewhere. Like, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like wide awake about a thing. Something happened the prior day that I still need to work through. Like, there's something that's still gnawing on me. There's something that's out of balance there. It's you learn from sort of these healthy habits when they're broken. You get to understand, like, oh, I've got a system problem here I have to go fix somewhere, which is, who knows, any number of things could be broken.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's shift topics for now and talk about leadership. And what I'm curious your thoughts about are, as if you imagine someone who's moving in a different direction in their career, let's say moves from being a manager to a director to a VP, and so by nature of that, your team is getting larger and larger. The number of people that you oversee is ostensibly, probably a lot of the times, going to be getting larger and larger, and that obviously your role is going to be changing as well. Or you have a situation, maybe you're a manager and you were working for a startup and your team was 5 people, and boom, then it's 10, and then boom, and then it's 20. And so all of a sudden your team has quadrupled in size. So what adjustments would you say, or to frame it another way, what adjustments have you made in your leadership strategies to make sure that you're still adding value and still doing the things that you need to do as a leader, but your team is growing?
That is like 9 questions. it's hard. Let's see. I think let's split that into 2 spaces. There's sort of the small company getting really, really big. So actually, no, there's the startup leadership, and then there's sort of the progression from manager to director to VP. I think those are probably 2 buckets to start with, and then we can see where we go with it. Let's talk about VP, director, and manager. Mm-hmm. Let's see how to start there. It's like I should write a book on this or something. I think let me just talk about lessons from that. There are three very different roles, and they're all leadership roles, but they are evolving from, let's think about it from sort of a, what they're responsible for. A manager, she is looking down to her team, and she is responsible for her team, looking down, not from a, like up on a pedestal or anything. It's like, that's her responsibility is the team. The director is moving more into looking across the organization. He is looking at who are my peers, who are my other directors, who are my set of managers, but managers that are looking down to their respective teams. And then the VP is, he or she is responsible for looking at the whole system and also looking at how the world is viewing that team. So they're kind of external facing in a little bit, just like I'm sitting here right now. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to look at it, is sort of like team, the entire organization, and sort of like the entire planet. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of one way to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's happening in that growth of leadership is that it's my expectation of those leaders is that they are moving from tactical to strategic, with VPs being responsible for the strategy of the things, and directors being responsible for some strategy but on some tactics, and for managers being some strategy but mostly tactical, right? So sort of look at any sort of career path, it's sort of you're moving from like being highly directed to being not directed whatsoever. And that's the work there, is because we trust your judgment to get things done. So I think that's another way, another spectrum to land on top of that. I don't want to say it gets harder. It gets, the thing that I like to see out of managers and directors, when they start to quote unquote get it, is when they truly can give up the I for the we. And it's hard, because as an individual, it's I doing this thing, and you know that you're part of a team. But the first thing I, when I see a manager take over a new team, is what I'm looking for is when he goes and is able to give up something that he knows he could do better himself, because he trusts the team enough to like say, okay, here's this big rock, I have to do that. And that delegation move, as you move from manager to director to VP, mm-hmm. gets really, really powerful, because me, as a vice president of engineering, I delegate just about everything, which seems super weird. And the first question should be, so what do you do all day? I'm like, I've got plenty to do. Mm-hmm. But mostly what I'm doing is growing my team by saying, here's this huge, amazingly complex thing. I trust you can do it. And I know it's probably you're gonna get a B on this, but like, you are gonna learn a ton from this, and I'm gonna help you do this. Mm-hmm. And like, that took me years and years to learn, to be able to understand the people, understand that my job was to delegate to folks, and to like, that was gonna allow me to be a force multiplier. There's this thing about that engineers wrestle with, which is sort of giving up the code and no longer feeling like they're productive because they're not like writing the code and checking the code and that whatnot. Yep. And for me, the craft of building teams and being able to work with a team to kind of understand, to work with me to understand the vision that I have and be able to have them run with it and me sort of orchestrating from it, that's the dream. And that's the same, it's a very similar satisfying action of like, I'm still building things. They're much fuzzier than the code, because it's all of these wonderful people and getting things done. But there's that sense of getting satisfaction, kind of almost watching it at a distance, as opposed to, you know, building it with your hands. So there's that maturing perspective, that's maturing, that there's that distance that's happening as you're moving up the moving around the leadership path. So that was a long answer.
It was like you said, it was like 9 questions. So and I realized that. But yeah, thank you for taking the time to really think through that. So yeah. That distance, what you're talking about is giving up the I for the we. Is that what you were kind of referring to there? Mm-hmm. In that, as you go from director to VP, that it's not just about what I'm doing, it's about what the team is doing, and you need to appreciate that more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the one of the things I make sure that I put in, like, I do performance reviews every 6 months right now, and it's just my own style of doing it. But one of the things that I always put in there, and it's been in there for years, is you need to be able to tell me, for anyone on your team, what is their growth path? And like, what are you doing to encourage their growth? And it can be a simple thing, like, oh, they're running this thing, but it's like, that's the thing that to me is one of the valuable things of becoming a more senior leader is, mm-hmm. like, that's your job, is to actually grow folks and to know how to do it. And they're all different, and periodic beautiful snowflakes. And what Frank needs is different than what Bob needs, which is different than what Jules needs. So, and you got to be able to like know all those different personalities and know what all the moves are to actually grow them. Because that's what they're really looking for. They're looking for the same thing we were talking about earlier, which is like that sense of growth. This is, we want to keep people happy and engaged. Like, they have to feel like they're growing. They have to know that they're growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and trust seems to be a topic here that's kind of beneath the surface that's definitely relevant to what you've been talking about today, and it's something that you talked a lot about at your Calibrate talk a little while ago in San Francisco. And one of my favorite quotes from that talk that you gave at Calibrate was about trust, and it was that building trust by building others, that's management.
Yeah.
Really echoes what you were just saying there, that it's about, it's really about encouraging it's about them. That if you're not building them, if you're not building that trust, then you're not leading, then you're not doing your job.
Yeah. When you have that trust and respect thing and with you and your team, so many things get easier. Like when the sky falls, as it invariably does, everyone rallies to each other, as opposed to well, who's screwed in this scenario? Right? It's like, we have to figure this thing out, right? Even though there's something was broken and someone probably caused that brokenness, it's like they just rally together. And there's not finger pointing, there's not politics, it's like, we need to figure this thing out. And when you see that work, you know that when the team is high trust and trusting of you, it's just a lot of the drama and the bolts, your BS, goes away. Another good example, I know when I have connected with someone, when they tell something to me, the VP of engineering at Slack, and they say, this thing you did, you kind of screwed it up. And I'm like, first of all, I don't get panicky. I have I've heard a lot of feedback over my career from a lot of different folks. I'm like, what are you saying? And how do I feel about that? And what am I going to do with it? Right? Let's get in there. I'm like, thank you. Let me go figure that out. And it's not to say I'm always emotionalness about it. Sometimes it's like, oh, gosh, I hate when I do that. But it's not they are attacking me or they are saying something that is hostile, even if they're coming at me kind of hot. I was like, no, I gotta figure out how I heard this and how I'm going to deal with that. And that, to me, that sort of just like understanding that feedback is a gift and all of these things we say in high trust, that's the thing that I love to see as it's a good sign that there's trust on the team when you're getting those sorts of behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a great example. And one-on-ones, to segue a little bit, one-on-ones are a way, are definitely one of the ways that we can build trust with our teams. Having that one-on-one time is just so sacred. And to kind of tie it back to the original 9 questions, let's scale it down a little bit to more like 2 or 3 questions. What about one-on-ones? What happens? How do one-on-ones change as, let's say, let's use the manager to director to VP progression again? Right. How do one-on-ones change as one would move through that career progression?
It's changing in as much as that you have managers talking with ICs and then directors talking with managers and ICs and VPs talking with directors. So the role is changing, but the intent is not. I'm pretty religious about regular one-on-ones every week, 30 minutes, no matter what. And the reason I am is because it is the most obvious way for me to build that trust and respect piece. My one-on-ones are not about status. I mean, there's things are talked about in terms of status, but they're very small. They're usually topics of substance. What is the right org structure here? How do we feel about leadership here? What about onboarding? And it's a debate and it's a discussion and it's strategic work. And by the way, it's always fun because we get to talk about whatever that big sort of meaty topic is. And you do that every week. Everyone knows that it's a time that we can be strategic and kind of talk through a set of things. People start to trust you and learn where they understand how you think. They understand that you want to hear what they have to say. It's not a transactional tactical meeting. It's a strategic meeting. And it can be coaching moments. It can be all of these things. And it's just, for me, it's that trust thing. It's a really easy way to start building that trust. And especially with a new team, it's a good way to kind of learn folks, kind of figure things out. But it's like, these are essential. And I am aware when I miss a one-on-one with someone for a week or two, I'm like, oh my, I have this gap in my sort of conversation with them. And I'm assuming they feel the same way about me. Different folks do one-on-ones in different ways. We always have a running sort of to-do list, but I always have one or two things that are sort of like, on my mind that I kind of like, let's get to the whiteboard and figure this thing out. So, but they're the trust and respect piece. That's the basic thing is there's this weekly investment in your team.
Mm-hmm. So that must mean then, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that your calendar, a lot of your calendar time is spent in one-on-one meetings.
That's kind of true, but I also have this religion about team size. It's 7 ± 3. So, because I believe that people, you know, if you have 10 or more direct reports, chances are you don't have time for people, because as you pointed out, that'd be a lot of time. Mm-hmm. 10 one-on-one, 30 minutes, blah, blah, blah. So I do have a lot, but I also keep my team size relatively small so that I have the time to do the one-on-ones and all the other meetings that are happening and the curveball things that happen every week. And also, I should have said this earlier, I try to carve off about 5 hours a week on my daily calendar, which is just lock time, which is I got to write this thing, I want to research this thing over here. So I have that as well. So if I ever am looking at my one-on-one schedule and it's overloaded, I make some adjustments.
And so, and so because of the team size, so if your team is going to be, let's say, 10 people maximum, that's 10 meetings maximum.
Yeah.
So that's 5 hours a week maximum if it's 30 minutes. So that's not too much. That makes a lot of sense, because I've talked with managers who have teams a lot larger than that, 10, 20. And they say, you know, I'd love to have weekly one-on-ones with everyone, but I can't make it work, because otherwise I'm just going to be going to one-on-ones and I get the importance of it, but there's other stuff that I need to do as well.
Isn't that a red flag to you? It's a red flag to me. I don't know who these people are, so I can talk about them, but like, I don't have time for my people. Like red flag, like right there, 20 direct reports. I don't know who this person is, but I would say if you have 20 direct reports, there's a good portion of those folks that something's wrong and the manager doesn't know it. He or she can't help, right? Like that seems like not a good scenario. But again, I am this fan of small teams with managers who are really, really, really tasked with the care and the care of their team. So, but like 20, like I would push the big red button. We have a situation here.
Right. Stop the presses. Right. Exactly. Let's figure out how to fix this. So is this something that you've just been kind of lucky in, that the teams that you've inherited have been small, or have you made an effort to say, look, this team is too big, we need to pare this down and split it up a little?
When I first arrived at Slack, I had 3. And that was kind of awesome. I was like, I got some bandwidth here, people, when I first arrived. And it was great, because really talented team. But over time, I've inherited some more. So I think I'm taking it 7 right now, which is kind of my sweet spot. Mm-hmm. I'm always pushing teams based on sort of the seniority of the manager, director, whoever, to kind of get to that sort of sweet spot. And if I have too many, I will figure out a way to get it rearranged that someone else who maybe doesn't have a lot can get there. Of course, not reorient just for team size. There's also business considerations and strategy there, but I'm just always kind of optimizing in that way. Mm-hmm. And again, there's lots of ways to structure leadership. This is my way of doing it. There's other companies that have lots more direct reports, but I just think you're probably not getting the most out of your humans if your manager isn't sort of like in touch with his or her team. That's my philosophy though.
Yeah, and it makes sense that if you're feeling like there's too many to lead, that there's going to be gaps. There's going to be like those communication gaps that you're just not going to be able to pick up on, because like one person can't know what 15 or 20 people are doing at any point in time, or what they're talking about, or, you know, to something you talk about, what rumors are kind of starting to bubble up that you could squash if it was a smaller team. But if it's a bigger team, you know, who knows what can happen in that rumor mill.
Yeah, it's a drama prevention measure.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so let's transition to the last question. And this is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Um, biggest challenge is probably striking a balance on, let me tell you a story. So here's the way that it kind of has gone in a lot of the companies that I've been at, and I'll get to the challenge in a second. The way that it works in terms of rapid growth is that you're small and there's no one's a manager, but it gets big enough that someone has to be a manager reluctantly, and he or she starts to do that sort of thing. And then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and there's more managers. And at some point, someone says, "Hey, I want to know what my career path is." And someone who helpfully, with set of other folks, helps and says, "Here's the career path for individual contributors, engineers, whatever it is." So great, we have a career path now, and it serves as a rubric for managers to make calls about, like, okay, you're two, this is what you need to do to be a three. Something really interesting happens when that career path lands, and then someone has to decide, well, is Sally a four or a five based on their memory? Who decides that? They don't volunteer, because everyone would always like say, "Well, I'm a nine." So someone has to make that educated, hopefully fair call. Those are usually managers. And this is a wake-up point for a lot of folks. They're like, "Oh, these managers have some power." And this super interesting thing happens where suddenly this whole set of people say, "Well, I want the power too." And I mean power like in a douchebag way, it's just sort of like more influence. So suddenly all of these folks, and again, I've seen this time and time again, all of these rodeos, where they're like, "Okay, I want to be a manager," like, which doesn't even have a career path yet. So they're leaving this well-defined career path to the thing that doesn't actually exist yet because of this bright and shininess of what the management piece is. And the interesting thing, I'm writing about this, which is why I'm telling you this long story, is that it's not that they want to be managers. Maybe some of them legit want to do that. They want this thing that we've been talking about, which is growth, and they see that that's a place to grow. Which leads me to, like, what my challenge is, which is, I believe in any company, you're going to have a career path for the individual contributors, and you're going to have a career path for the managers. Different roles, different sets of responsibilities, obviously totally intertwined, but like different roles. But the thing is, the leadership thing, which managers are usually associated with, managers are leaders. That's true, but leadership comes from everywhere. And when an engineer wants to jump over to manager, and I know that he's just going to be bad because he doesn't have some of like the basic skills, and maybe we can get him there. I go and say, like, why doesn't he want to stay there to be an engineer? It's because those leadership opportunities aren't obvious to the organism. They're not there as like that sense of influence and power. And again, lowercase p power, not in a douchebag way, just sort of influence is a better way to think about it. Those things need to be as readily apparent for the individual contributors as they are obvious with managers. So you got to define those, and they have to be visibly displayed and people doing them, whether that's tech lead or like Google, they call it a tech lead manager. Have those exist because they allow the folks to be great engineers to start developing leadership skills, to start developing their influence skills, all those things that the managers are getting to sort of by trial by fire on their career path. So it's a very, very long answer to your question, but everyone wants to grow, and you want to have like those folks who are going to be great individuals have all that leadership growth opportunity. And for the managers, all that leadership growth opportunity. And what I'm describing here, those balance between those ICs and those managers, that being balanced between those two paths, is really kind of awesome because it flattens the org chart. Managers aren't seen as these folks that are like, making all the decisions and deciding who gets paid what and blah, blah, blah. That's some of the things that they do, but they're if they're allowing a lot, they're delegating things to these TELs, these TLMs, these senior engineers, there's that sense of like balance between the two. You don't get in these weird hierarchical political situations. So I don't know if that's the biggest people-related challenge I have. I've just been thinking about it a lot because I've really screwed it up like really well a couple of times. And this time I really don't want to do that. So I'm thinking about that a lot. And it's just tied in with this thing we've been talking about over and over again, which is like everyone wants to grow and they should just have this obvious, clear path in front of them. And they should be able to look around and see people that are on that path in different ways so they know that it's credible. And like that has to be built. It's not something that just magically shows up. because people are, you know, trying to do their best.
Yeah, that makes total sense, and I can absolutely relate to that. That this idea of growth, right? You have these super smart people. They're not just going to want to stay where they are. They're going to want to grow. But it's like, oh, I guess that means I need to become a manager. Well, if there's an alternate path, here, let me show you the way. But that's not always there for them, and that can get frustrating.
Yeah, it's a lot. Like some of the biggest mistakes I've made is engineers who just are not ever going to be good at it. They just don't have the natural skills. We can get most people there, but like, they're just not. This is where we started, right? Like, I'm happiest. I have the best job ever because I'm doing the job I'm supposed to be doing. I'm good at it. There's lots of interest in it. There's a little bit of fear in it. Like, that's the same thing. I've had to like demote folks, not at Slack and prior meetings, where it's like, you're a great engineer. And like, let's you go be great at what you're good at. This manager thing is, you've done it for 2 years. It's not working. And the trajectory is not anyone, no one's happy with that. So I think that's one of my big challenges.
So the big challenge is would you describe it as helping the folks who maybe want to stay on that IC path and sort of figuring out the direction for them? Or would you classify the or characterize the challenge in a different way?
It's making sure there's a growth path for every person there, a credible growth path for every type of human there is. And that's what I've just described sounds super simple. It's super hard.
Yeah. Going back to it, it makes sense that everybody should have, that we should want to have, we should eat right and we should sleep and we should exercise and everyone should have a great career path, right? It's simple, but it's not easy to actually execute, especially because it's not something that where you can just wave a magic wand and say, here, this happens. It requires collaboration. It requires working within an existing culture with a team. But it's certainly an admirable goal to meet.
I made a career. This is my wife makes fun of me for this. I made a career out of stating the obvious. I was like, eat healthy. Like, oh yeah, you're right. But the thing is, we all of these things that are really obvious to us, like trust and respect, by the way, of course we should all trust and respect each other, but like, especially in a business context, that's something that has to actually be built. It's not something that just comes because we're family or this sort of thing. So it's these obvious things, especially in groups of people who are political and strange and whatnot, I think the obvious things are just super important to pay attention to. But yeah, they're all like, if you read my stuff, I'm very obvious. I'm always saying something that's like, oh yeah, I should do that, right? That seems like really obvious to me. But these are the things we forget to do.
They are. We do. We forget the obvious, especially those of us who become overly analytical and get too deep in the weeds. And we think that there must be some harder answer to this. It's got to be more complex than this. No, actually, no. It's pretty obvious. It's pretty simple. Executing, you know, that's different. But I think stating the obvious needs to be done more. So thank you for that.
That's what I do. The other thing is, when you get all those obvious things out of the way, you can actually spend the time on like sort of the harder, more strategic vision pieces. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to worry about how you slept last night when you're worrying about the career path for individual contributors. You want all those things just to be assumed and like healthy.
Yep. Absolutely. So I think that's just about a good time to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Michael, for a great conversation. It was awesome talking with you today.
Absolutely. It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great.